Everything you asked me to, I never thought you ever would ask me to leave, baby. I guess the joke's on me, baby. You never did feel too deceived. I guess that's what I get for being so quality, baby.
All right, I am bringing Man vs. Mob Radio live onto the air now, and even though pretty much nothing is prepared yet, I am doing trial by fire. Don't worry, guys. I can take it slow. So, welcome to Man vs. Mob Radio. If you don't recognize my voice, I am your host, Patrick Clerkin. I'm on every Monday from 7 to 8, and you are listening right now to 91.5 WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. And my guests tonight in studio are Chris and Luke, who might or might not be participating. I'm not sure. He's kind of just shadowing the show to see what it's about. But Chris, does your mic work?
Yeah, I think I can hear myself.
Cool, cool. And Luke, does your mic work?
Testing.
Does not work. Hold on a second. Let me put this on.
I can hear him.
Testing.
Does that work?
Yeah, it works. I can hear myself. No?
I would move to the other.
Alright.
Can you take it over?
Testing.
That's way better. That's
testing.
Now okay. You can, yeah, I can hear you. You're good. Okay, cool. So,
so it's best to figure that out on air.
Exactly. Well, I think people like to participate in the action. Okay, so people listening, if you don't know what Man vs. Mob Radio is, it's essentially my attempt to, bring up some interesting topics and engage with people who have things that they want to talk about. So one of the things that I really like to do is facilitate connections and conversations between people. So if you have something that you just really want to get off your chest or that you want to discuss, I encourage you to call in to our studio line, which is 855-915-9636. Once again, that's 855-915-9636. And if you forget those last digits, those last four, it's actually WMFO, which is the studio name itself. So I'm going to try to repeat that a couple times throughout the program. I haven't been the greatest at that in the past, but I'm going to try to continue to do that. So let's see. All right, Chris, we sort of were talking before about some of the things that I was thinking of talking about tonight. And one of the first ones, which you had partial familiarity with and a pretty strong opinion on, I think, was the OK Boomer meme. So I was curious, do you want me to explain a little bit some of the background of where it originated?
Yes, please. Okay. You're a little more tech, internet savvy than me.
I don't know too much about it, but let me just fill the listeners in who aren't familiar with it, if you aren't familiar with it, kind of where it came from, what it means. So what I heard was that there was a young woman, a millennial woman, who was speaking in front of the UN, might have been talking about climate change. I'm not quite sure what she was talking about, but basically she had a heckler in the audience, somebody who was roughly in their late 50s, 60s, something like that. And, you know, they were being rude, and her response was a dismissive, okay, boomer. And it just became this internet phenomenon, and everybody kind of ran with it, and all these memes came out of it. So, the origin of it is just basically that the sentiment that a lot of older people are out of touch with the problems of today. That's kind of where it came from.
Well, I didn't know it originated from someone having a dismissive comment, making it dismissively to someone. That's even...
Yeah, so, the way that I look at it is, I think it's a bit... I think it's funny, but I also think it's a bit too dismissive. I think it's a little bit needless when it comes to trying to create those generational divisions. I mean, we have a ton of divisions right now, right? I don't think we need to add generational division on top of that.
It's very catty too.
It is very catty. I mean, it was
it's an uneducated thing to say, in my opinion. But if I hear someone say that, I think a little less of their conversation ability anyway.
I think the original comment it was clever and off the cuff, but yeah, to try to, and people are really particular, I call them pop journalists, particularly pop journalists are really trying to run with it, and they're trying to, you know, the whole Mean Girls make fetch happen. Like, they're trying to make the okay boomer thing happen. They're like, oh, is this a sign of intergenerational warfare? And it's like, not really. Like, if you try to push it to be that, then it could get worse than it is, but it's really not. It's like a bunch of people on the internet kind of, you know, millennials and boomers throwing memes back and forth at each other, basically.
Well, it's also, when I hear people talk about it outside of the memeing world, it's very, like, mad at mommy and daddy, sort of, like...
Pretty much.
The way it was described to me originally was that boomers are out of touch because their lives were so much easier back in their day.
By the way, you might want to lift your mic up a little bit and just...
Their life was so much easier back in their day. It was easier to get a job, you could work 40 hours on minimum wage and get a house and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And I find that very, even if that is the case, so what?
Yeah.
It's not that time now to figure something out and start hustling. To yell about mom and dad's life is, how old are you? Come on.
I am totally with you there. I will say also that I am quite entertained by the, so, you know, memes are millennials' domain, and to see boomers creating their own memes and using them as weapons is quite funny to watch. It's equivalent to watching millennials try to do, I don't know, to try to change their own tire or something like that.
It's trying,
like,
to discuss a Roth IRA.
Or anything requiring life skills. Like, it's, and by the way, people, I am using generalizations, okay? I think that we've kind of lost touch with what a generalization is. The problem in the past when we were making generalizations is that we would always forget the exceptions to the generalization, the many, many exceptions. And today we sort of have the reverse problem where we only acknowledge the exceptions and we pretend like there's no rule or no signal through the noise, which is like the reverse problem. Oh, no, you can't make a generalization or a stereotype. It's like, no, these things exist. You know, if you overuse them, they're bad, but you can get there's a lot of humor in them and there's a lot of truth in them. So, you know, like these, I think that there's merit, particularly in some of these generational, like there are strengths and weaknesses of each generation, in my opinion. And to acknowledge them, I don't think is wrong, but to over prescribe them, I think is wrong. So, I think that...
Or even to say, like, someone of the past generation can't help or be of use to anyone of our generation because they don't know. They don't... Their skill set that they've developed isn't going to be practical or helpful to anyone in this day, I think, is a very closed-minded and unproductive way to look at anything.
I'm completely in agreement with that. Yeah, it's... What I think is extremely troubling right now is that the generations, I think, really need, and by the way, I don't mean to leave Gen X out of this because I've seen plenty of, back to the memes, I've seen plenty of memes where, you know that, I think it's like a little monkey cartoon character where it's, he's looking to the side and then he's looking forward. That, you know, the meme that I'm talking about? It's like a, it's kind of like a little puppet or a Muppet or something. Like, there's one panel where he's looking off to the side and another panel where he's just looking straight forward. Anyway, so... there's a lot of depictions of Gen X kind of like being caught in the crossfire of millennials and boomers, you know, like talking crap about each other. So I don't mean to leave Gen X out of it, but basically my point is that I think that the generations need each other. They each have strengths and weaknesses. And I think that right now, particularly with the younger generations, Zs and the younger millennials, there's all this passion and energy without any direction. And so
it's like throwing your car in neutral and flooring it in the driveway.
Exactly. It's completely like, it's like an explosion almost, you know, like, explosions don't have any particular direction. They just shoot out everywhere. So that's kind of what it is. And what they need, in my opinion, is leadership. And one of the ways that you get leadership is with wisdom. And that's what the older generations have, is wisdom. They've lived life. They've seen all kinds of things. And I think that basically, you know, the boomers, the silent GI generation, those generations have all of that wisdom to contribute, but they're dismissed by the younger generations because they don't know how to use an iPhone quickly enough. and the older generations dismiss the younger generations because they're out of touch with, you know, whatever cultural things that they know and the things that they grew up with, basically.
To play as devil's advocate, though, wouldn't the argument be for the young people that if they were to take a hold of this wisdom and have their leader be someone of that generation, that it's mm-hmm. not, they're falling for the same pratfall of listening to the system or the establishment that's already in place, as opposed to being young kids that think they can change themselves?
I don't. So you're saying that it would be kind of betraying the...
Yeah, they might see it as a little disingenuous because as much as they want to change the world, they have to listen to the brass that's already in place to do so because they have the wisdom, to your comment.
I think as long as the brass adopts some of the kind of modern wisdom as well into their the wisdom of their time.
Do you mean work together and exchange ideas and mold the two bits of knowledge together?
Pretty much. I know that sounds extreme, but yeah, that's exactly it. Is that when you have the influences of both, it can work. You know, I don't think that we're going to be reconstructing anything that existed in the past or anything that we're looking back with rose-colored glasses, right? You know, we're not going to create any replica of anything that has existed. We have all these new things, these new technologies, these new systems in place, and I think we kind of need to adapt with what we have. And I think that there are plenty of hip people, boomers, whatever, who could work within that, in my opinion. So that was really just the main point, is that I would like to see more acknowledgement and respect between generations. Like, we know what our negative stereotypes are, but let's focus on the positive sides of each generation too. Yeah. So
that's people. That's not even generational. We all have friends that mm-hmm. have some poor qualities and some pretty good qualities.
Yeah,
it's a blending of it. It's a mix. You take them both.
Yeah, I think that people—it's just a new axis that people are trying to look at it now. So that's why. I mean, the explosion of the OK Boomer thing is just why it seemed particularly relevant. But yeah, it's all over the place.
I would think that the people making that meme are like high schoolers. I assume that all people making memes are high schoolers.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be a younger crowd.
Yeah, probably mostly Z or Xennials or whatever. But yeah, I would agree with you. So the second topic was, this is more just entertaining. So I, on Friday, was working, I did a shift as a bouncer at a bar, a local bar. I'd never done that before.
How'd you get that gig? Just the tallest guy in the room?
No, I walked into the bar one afternoon and said, you know, could I get a job? Are you taking applications for bartenders? And they said, no, we're actually pretty full up right now, but if you wanted to work some shifts at the door, maybe that you could, you know, get a foot in. So I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. At the very least, it's interesting. And let me tell you that it is the, so I was in a fraternity in college, and it is the exact same thing. I don't think the term is comforting. It is a little bit comforting to know that people don't change, but also a little bit disturbing at the same time. But you just see the same exact things with people who are 10, 20 years older. So, for example, there was always, we're going to establish a set of rules. Nobody's going upstairs at the party. So some brother stand guard at the foot of the stairs, and they're doing their job, being ultra vigilant. And then some brother comes along and said, maybe with some seniority, and goes, all right, like, this hot girl wants to go upstairs, let them go upstairs. And then, like, the rules, the system breaks down, and the same exact thing was happening you know, like, one of the bouncers would be vigilantly maintaining the rules. Nope, you're not getting in. It's the rule of the bar. Once you cross the threshold, you're out. And then one of the guys with a little bit of seniority would come over and be like, oh no, like, just let her back in, after the guy had told the woman like 25 times that she wasn't coming back in. So you see that. You see just like the drama of everything. I don't know. Do you have any, I presume you've never been in a bouncer situation, but have you, do you have any interesting bar stories that you can share?
I got more bar things than you can. I'll tell you, I got, one of the bars I got years ago, I was in Connecticut. I was at a concert, a Big D and the Kids Table concert, right up in your neck of the woods in Brighton. I was doing something. I remember I was drinking Red Bull and vodka for whatever reason. I don't know why I would have ever been in that situation. Mm-hmm. But I was, and something had happened, and I mouthed off to the bartender or the bouncer, and he threw me out. And you know how you know how bouncers throw you out. They throw you a foot past the threshold of the door and then go back in and eat mozzarella sticks. So I just walked back in. Yep. And walked back to the show and was standing in the crowd, and the guy walked by and saw me again, and he grabbed me and he threw me out of the bar that time.
Like, and by the hitch of the belt?
Oh, by the forearm, and just dragged me out. And so he throws me out, so I start walking around the street because my buddy was still in the show.
Yeah.
We went there with five people, and I bump into one of my other guys in the group, and I was, hey, Pete, what are you doing? And he's like, I got thrown out. Oh, no kidding. So we're laughing and having a good time. We walk a little bit further. We see our friend Matt. He got thrown out. Everyone but our one friend got thrown out.
And he's probably wondering where everybody was.
Oh, he's busy telling all of us to wait by the car.
Yeah.
We stumble around. But yeah, I get all kinds of bar stories. Luke, do you have any bar stories?
I have too many.
It's hard to...
One good one.
I'm thinking about the time that I went to one of those bar stool, was it foam tour, where they dumped the suds? No, it wasn't the blackout tour, it was like the suds tour, and it was out in Springfield, and I was with...
Was there an effort to try and clean up the city?
Yeah, it might have been. It might have been multi-purpose. So I wasn't really into it because we had left a party at UMass Amherst to attend to this because one of the people in the group had tickets, and I think the rest of us bought some tickets to it just to kind of, you know, go along. And so I was the one that was kind of timing, going, all right, we're only going to be here for an hour and a half or 2 hours or something like that, then we're going to go back, hit the party. And so at some point near maybe 15 minutes from when we were supposed to go, they start dumping the suds everywhere, which is obviously what the whole thing is about. But I don't think I really fully comprehended what the event was. So it just starts dumping everywhere, and I can't find or recognize anyone or anything. I'm trying to get the other people that I went with back to the car. Did not work. So yeah, trying to find people in a room full of, like, basically like a giant bathtub. Not easy.
That sounds kind of fun, though. That's better than just having to walk around a house party.
I wish that I wasn't trying... I wish that I didn't have an agenda that night, otherwise I would have enjoyed it a bit more.
I think on second thought, my best bar story, hands down, had to be in Nashville.
Sure. Share it.
Literally just spent a whole day. It's my last full day in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Full day after brunch in my hotel. My dad was like, oh, I'm going to take your brother and your cousin just exploring. And, like, I kind of just wanted to go on a bang my last day. So, literally after brunch, I'm like, hey, Dad, to all the Johnny Cash museums.
Clarification, go out and bang your last day or go out
go on
and
like a bang?
Go out on a bang.
Oh, okay, go out on a bang. Oh, got it.
All right, so.
I wanted to go out and bang. I've been standing around this Johnny Cash wax model all night. Don't stop and wait.
Okay, I'm with you.
Well, we had gone to the museum before brunch, and then at that point it was like almost 10 a.m., mm-hmm. and we were walking down Broadway where all of like the big country bars are, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna start pregaming. And sure enough, going to this one bar, it was I think it was the Toby Keith's, which I started off at. Mm-hmm. So had a few rounds there, and then after that, like, the live music was cool. I left a tip because they're actually really friendly. Mm-hmm. Everybody in Nashville is so friendly.
Isn't it mostly bachelorette parties?
I was actually about to say that. Yeah. Yes, it's mostly bachelorette parties, and they have those it's kind of like, you know those, it's not really it looks like a unicycle, but it's when they have all these drunk chicks.
It looks like a Dr. Seuss device.
Yeah, exactly. They're always doing that shit. And so anyways, so I went to, after that, I went to Kid Rock's. And as I kept going to these bars after a couple rounds, after closing out, I go to the next one. Mm-hmm. As I go to these bars, literally, like, every single bartender is, like, this hot tattoo chick. And that's exactly my type of girl, for the most part. Like, mm-hmm. Depends on, like, the girl and their personality, but appearance-wise, like, slim, tattoos.
Yeah.
Like, you got me.
Okay.
So, they will literally flirt with me, and at this point, I'm already, like, drunk.
They will, like, literally flirt with you? This is what bartenders do. You're sounding like the people who go to the strip club and say, I think the stripper likes me.
No, well...
if you ever date a bartender, too, and they come home and they tell you some of the tact... Yeah, so you know, they're putting on an act.
Yeah, well...
Okay, well, fair enough. We'll put that aside. Continue.
Well, at this point, I was getting more intoxicated, so I was progressively giving higher and higher tips because I was having too many drunk conversations with bartenders, and it was just a way, like, oh, she did really good service, like, and I had too many drinks, so, so, basically, like, I didn't stop until like 1 a.m. It was that bad, and I got back, flew back on basic economy because we had flown down that way on basic economy, and yeah, my bank account hated me the rest of the summer. But so I gotta tell you, it was worth it. The whole experience in Nashville was worth it. Visiting the Grand Ole Opry, the Jack Daniel's Distillery, all of it was worth it. Like, not one single regret going there.
You're about the third or fourth person to tell me that. So I guess I'll have to schedule a trip to Nashville one of these days.
You got to.
And I'll beware of the tattooed bartenders.
Yeah, if you're single, it's fun.
Yeah, I kind of feel like running a gauntlet of bachelorette parties, though. It's like, although that sounds in theory like a good thing, and it could be, it also sounds like it could be really annoying if you're just not in the right mood. Like, you can only deal with so many, like, yeah, I'm just thinking about, like,
loud requests and a hard man is good to find t-shirts.
Yep. And I don't know what penis antenna.
I was thinking the penis candy straws. Penis.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when you don't know which one is actually the chick getting married who's, like, drunk flirting with you.
I'm not buying you a gift. What do you care? You're an out-of-towner.
Oh, I have kind of a good story based on that. So, like, this is something that I never... and I guess that probably guys don't do this as much anyway, but, you know, like, women tend to look for the ring on guys' hands, right, at the bar. So, one of my friends, he... this is a couple summers back. We were in Newport, Rhode Island for the 4th of July, and he came up with the idea of buying a ring online to just appear like he was married at the bar, because it was his theory that women were attracted to married men. And so he went to the bar wearing this ring, and I believe that he had to then, like, maintain a, like, you know, when you tell people have fun at, and I get it, people have fun at the bars making up these fake personas and these stories, but then they forget the details of what they made up, and then they have to constantly kind of, like, keep up and go, oh, no, that's not what I meant. So that's basically what happened to him, whereas, like, he really kind of just, like, ended up freaking this woman out because he had this story that he couldn't maintain. And I think at the end of the night, like, he was sort of drunk, and she said, well, you know, like, what's the deal with the ring anyway? Like, what's, are you married or what? And so he, my friend turns to our other mutual friend and kind of said, okay, save me, get me out of this. And the other friend just goes, yeah, his wife is dead. She died in an accident recently. It's like, and it just kind of, like, completely killed the mood.
Oh, man.
But it was pretty freaking hilarious.
But he was available.
Oh, yeah. So I think that was the point. Yeah. I think that was the point. Yeah. Oh, no. She's dead. She died in an accident recently. I don't know how you expect that to end well at the the bar. Okay.
To your comment about making up personas, have you ever been to, like, an airport bar or somewhere? Do you have fun doing things like that?
I think it can be fun at the beginning, but then if you really start to get to know somebody and you like them, you've sort of dug a hole for yourself, because then you go, oh, well, everything I've told this person is a lie. Right? So, like, you know, it can be funny if your true intent is to just never really go anywhere with that person. And or maybe, you know, like, there's some kind of unspoken coy understanding between the two of you that you're both kind of just making stuff up. But... yeah, you can get into those weird situations that you can't backpedal out of. But it can be really fun to improvise. I guess I would say it's more enjoyable for me to watch other people attempt it. I'm more of a people watcher. I just get a kick going to bars and seeing the various things that people do. So that's my answer.
I don't want to keep going back to things that you already said.
That's okay.
But in terms of the generational thing you were talking about earlier, I spend a lot of time on the road. I have such an affinity for horrible, dingy dive bars with cigarette burns in the jukebox and just the where I love those places so much.
Yeah.
But when I go there and I'll see people our age, I do notice that they, for the most part, don't know how to converse with the normal patrons, like a 60-year-old plumber or a guy in Mississippi that does whitewashing or whatever.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, is that a generational thing, or is that something more where you can't, people have difficulty, when you're sitting there on your phone doing something, you can't relate to the roofer sitting next to you that spent all day on it. I always find it interesting. I make a point to try and talk to those people. And
yeah, that's a good question. I think it's partly generational. The technology obviously impedes people's ability to talk with each other and understand each other and to empathize and all that. But also, I would love to visit a place like Cheers. I have
you can go there.
Well, no, I mean, in the sense of not just a model of what was in the show, but the idea of you have Cliff the mailman next to Norm the accountant and next to Sam the bartender and whoever else, Fraser the psychologist, right? All those different walks of life, different stories, different experiences, people hang out in the same place. Cheers, where everybody knows your name. I think that's a cool idea. I don't know if bars were ever actually like that.
Bars are like that now. What do you mean? We all know townie bars.
Yeah, but I mean, like, is it really that much of a cross-section?
Yeah, amongst regulars.
Is it? Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. I don't go to it. I mean, I live maybe more close to more townie bars than I realize, but yeah, I would appreciate townie bars for sure more than clubs and things like that. 100%. But that's good. That's good to hear, because I was wondering if that was something that was more like I was talking about earlier, people just kind of looking back in rose-colored glasses to something that wasn't quite that way.
All right.
But you say that it is, so that's good.
Oh, yeah. I hate to be this guy who's going to say something and then not say it on the air, but while you were talking about Cheers, probably my best bar story is at Cheers, but I won't tell that one on the airwaves.
Okay.
But I'll tell you once we...
Is it like a dirty story?
It's not a dirty story. It's maybe just some details at the beginning that don't need to be...
Got it.
Shared
across the airwaves. All right, fair enough.
Not everyone needs to know my name.
By the way, I haven't given the studio line recently, so I should do that. 855-915-9636. Once again, 855-915-9636. And if you don't remember those last four digits, it's the studio name, WMFO. The reason I'm giving you that number is in case you hear something that we're talking about and you want to participate, you want to make a comment or request, whatever, just give us a call and you'll be live on the air to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
We're doing drinking stories, bar stories.
Exactly. We're doing bar stories. About to switch to a different topic, but you can, if you want to go back to a topic that we've already addressed and you just want to kind of like interject that in the middle of whatever we're talking about, I'm totally fine with it. Okay.
This is loose. You're chewing gum on air.
Exactly. I'm kind of having a tough time with it, to be honest with you.
That's why they don't tell you not to do it.
It's like I've forgotten how to chew gum. It seems like forgetting how to walk. And by the way, it is fascinating watching people just walk or run. You would think that there's just one or two ways to do that. And it's apparently not the case. Like, go to Wakefield sometime.
I live there.
You live in Wakefield?
Yeah.
I thought you lived in Bedford.
Oh, no, I've long since moved.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So go to Lake Quanapowitt, is that what it's called?
Lake Quanapollutant.
Yeah. I hope not, because I paddleboarded in there and I had the water wash over my feet and legs, so I hope it's not polluted. Not
damage done, don't even worry.
But just watch people running around the lake and you will see the most insane gaits ever. You remember from high school, from the running sports, you know, cross country, track, where people have the velociraptor thing where they move their arms like a velociraptor, and then there's the moving your arms side to side and the crazy hip swings, and you go, how the hell do people even function?
Like, I'm glad you mentioned
all the time.
What'd you say?
I see that all the time.
Yeah.
Around where I live, we have the Chestnut Hill Reservoir.
Oh, yeah.
sometimes, like, I don't really jog there unless it's the summertime. So winter, I usually just do treadmill at my gym.
Yeah. But
in the summertime, if it's a beautiful day, I'll just jog a few laps around the reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, some of these people I see, I saw one guy literally run like he's...
Like not Donkey like he's, Kong? You look like you're doing a Donkey
yeah,
Kong
like,
thing.
Not just that, but running like he is like running away in a horror movie. Like
oh,
without,
yeah.
Just without the scream, but he's just running like this.
Wait a second,
this.
His arms flailing over his
yeah,
head?
Yeah, he's just like... And like I don't know that if he had a, some sort of intellectual disability, which obviously like...
That would probably make sense.
I mean, I wouldn't think of make fun of that, to... but I just like... Either way, I was just really caught off guard by this guy.
Yeah, that's... somewhat startling to see that. Was he running towards you or away from you?
No, he was running like in the trajectory that a normal person would run in, but just the way or the method he was running was
it had flair.
Oh yeah, that's an understatement.
Okay, I just needed to get that into the ether there.
Probably so. Burns more calories though. Keep your shoulders going. Keep them.
That's a good point. That might be what it is. Those little weights that, what was it? Jazzercising.
Just imagine somebody saying like, "Why are you running that way?" So I can burn more calories. I burn more calories than you. So that's really a good way to get back to someone to say like, "Oh, I just burn more calories than you. I have to eat less now."
Actually, anytime you're caught doing something ridiculous, just say that I'm burning more calories than you.
That's going to be my new excuse. So if people are just going to look at me weird, I'm like, hey, I'm burning more calories than you. What's a judgment? I'm going to do that.
And then they're going to feel weird. Like that if you do that jujitsu super quick, they're going to look at you, what do they know that I don't? okay, so...
they know that every season swimsuit season.
Oh, yeah.
That's damn good advice.
So one of the next things that I was going to bring up, and you didn't really know the name, but it sounds like you kind of knew what I was talking about. So Greta Thunberg is a name that's in the news recently. And for anybody listening who doesn't know who that is, it's the little girl from Sweden who is very angry about climate change. And she's sort of become, I don't want to say a martyr figure because, you know, she's not dead, but she's becoming this icon of people who feel very passionately about climate change. Recently, there was a mural of her, a very large mural of her painted on the side of a building in San Francisco. And she's become, you know, like a figurehead of the climate movement. And there is a popular video that you can find of her, probably the most popular video of her, where she's just sort of like scolding humanity for our horrible behavior and for, you know, being reckless with our consumption, which, by the way, she does have a point, particularly in Western society. We tend to be a bit decadent with our consumption, and I get that. However, first point is probably not the best way to convince people to come on your side just by kind of ruthlessly scolding them. The second thing is that, and this is actually a pretty important thing, is so I believe she has Asperger's and anxiety disorder and maybe clinical depression. I'm not sure. Like, I don't want to, okay, you can.
Well, I know she has Asperger's syndrome. I don't know if she has, like, the other two. But
okay.
In the news, they're talking about, oh, she has Asperger's. She's on the high-functioning autism spectrum.
Okay. So... the reason I bring that up is because, and this is kind of a, I'm going to have to go a little bit back in a roundabout way to reach my point. But basically, so Chris, we've talked about the book The Bell Curve before, right, with Charles Murray.
Yeah.
So basically, if you don't know what that book is, and it's a controversial book. It's about, it was written in 1994 by Murray and Herrnstein, and it was about intelligence and intelligence testing. And four of the main claims were that intelligence can be quantified as a single value. It is rankable. It is mostly genetic, and it is unchangeable. Those were the main claims of some of the main claims of the book. I would say the largest claims. So I bring this up because so I read that book, very fascinating book, and then I actually read the book that I would say. The book is probably the largest criticism of the bell curve and the ideas of the bell curve, called The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould. And in that book, he talks about how
he talks about the history of intelligence testing, and he talks about how fraught with bias and error it was, and how originally, do you know what phrenology is, where you're comparing skulls? And originally there were to basically convey inferiority between different skulls, they were packing, they were putting mustard seed in the skulls, and they were packing some of them and not packing other ones, and they were measuring the volumes of that. And then they were taking that biased data, and they were omitting certain examples that didn't prove their point that they already had in their head, and the data was very flawed. And then on top of that, future intelligence testing was based upon, and basically our modern intelligence testing today is all kind of built upon that foundation, right? So you have lots of bias built into it, despite the fact that some amount of statistical technique was used. So I bring that up because I think that the same thing that happened there is happening with climate change, and people don't realize it, where it's like somebody like Greta Thunberg comes out and they're very anxious about, you know, the total catastrophe that is potentially awaiting us in the next couple decades, right? But I think that, first of all, we live in a very anxious time. So when people hear these doomsday prophecies, they kind of immediately jump onto them and want to do something about them to prevent them. But they also don't realize the amount of bias kind of that has been built into the assumptions. So like, for example, a lot of the predictions about what's going to happen over the next couple decades with climate change, they generally come up with like 6 or 7 simulations, right? And I think that what happens is these, I mentioned them before, kind of like pop journalists and pop scientists, like maybe Bill Nye the Science Guy and a lot of people who feel very passionately about climate change, right? I think that they take the worst possible of those different simulations, and then they present that as this is what's going to happen. And then there's this feedback mechanism where each person is then writing, like a game of telephone, each person is writing their article off of somebody else's article, and it's just ratcheting up the intensity of what's going to happen. And before you know it, you have like, you know, fire volcanoes and forest fires everywhere, and see the oceans becoming completely out of control, and all these different feedback mechanisms looping into each other. So like, I bring all this up because, you know, I think that we have a responsibility to be more, to be better with how we consume, to be less careless, be less wasteful. But I don't actually believe that it's going to be the doomsday that is kind of being pushed right now. I think it's an attempt to basically make people anxious so that you can mobilize, you can mass mobilize people. That's what I kind of see it as. So yeah, I don't know if I don't know if you have any input on that, but
no, I mean, I completely agree with you. If you're gonna have a call to action, you need to feel like you're fighting some sort of cause.
Yeah.
If your cause is something that's gonna happen 300 years from now, why'd you care?
Do you think that there's a drawback though to making people feel that anxious about it? If it's something that, you know, you do want to improve, but which, you know, like people feel like they're people basically make intensely drastic decisions when they feel like the effects of some catastrophe are immediate, right?
I think that the worst part of it would be that it's more disheartening to the people involved, the people that firmly believe that and put all their efforts in, and it's not an immediate result. They might not even live to see the results that their efforts in their lifetime do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll just lose interest and move on to the next thing. And that's disheartening, and that's worse than... To say it's all fire and brimstone and watch out, I think that most people are smart enough to know when someone's being hyperbolic and when someone isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's a certain contingent of people. I think this feeds into what I was talking about before with the passion without direction, is that, you know, particularly young people are looking for something, and they have plenty of things to be passionate about, right? But like I think they're more prone to high anxiety, and I think they don't necessarily realize the hyperbole that's being used. So, well, a lot of people use a lot. Well, a lot of people might realize that it's an effective tactic.
Or maybe the person that's speaking, I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe the person that they're getting this message from is relatively the same age as them. And they think, maybe if they don't believe fully what they're saying, they go, well, look at them. They're making a difference. What am I doing? I'm doing nothing. I'm sitting here watching them. I should be involved doing something. That creates a lot of stress with people of our generation as well, feeling that you're not
involved.
Or you have all this potential that is being petered away, clicking through something.
That's a pretty good point, yeah. Yeah, so you see these mass movements, and I get the need to do something, but it's like passion without direction. So I hope that some of that can be reined. I hope that that energy can be channeled in a fairly productive way, and in a way that doesn't basically overshoot. Like, this is something that I made a post about this, is that, you could have endless conversations about each of these, but looking back at the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terror, all of those efforts to eradicate something, that didn't have, that wasn't a group of people like, you know, the Nazis or something like that, to eradicate a thing. When you start a war on something without clear objectives as to what the limitations are or when victory is achieved, then you create, first of all, a money pit, and second of all, you create all types of unintended consequences.
For the war on drugs and the war on poverty too, that's a non-tangible villain, and you're fighting something that, for better or worse, will always exist. There will always be poor people. There will always be drugs.
That's what I'm saying. So, like, we need to be cautious before we engage in our war on carbon, right? That's what I'm saying, is, like, I think that that's kind of, like, where this is heading, is, like, we're declaring war on carbon.
We are?
And no...
I didn't even know we were in the war times.
Well, you look at the way that people are talking, and it's... I see it as heading in that direction, and I want to make sure that we learn from history and really think about the unintended consequences of actions that we'll take, particularly massive action, particularly major mobilizations of people. I mean, those wars that I mentioned before largely destabilized inner cities, rural towns. That would be the war on poverty. Central and South America, that'd be the war on drugs, and the Middle East would be the war on terror. So before we destabilize something else major with our war on carbon, let's, like, think this one out. And I think that, like, that's where I'm not criticizing the energy. I'm criticizing the fact that, like, when you get too amped up, you tend to act and not think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that we should, like, whoa. Slow down a little bit. We're all kind of on the same page that we should do something, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. So, anyway, that was my point with that. Anything to add?
I don't know. I think we also live in a very energetic, anxious place. I was up in central Maine over the weekend, and just talking to the people around town, it's like they don't know what's going on. They don't care. They don't need to. They're happy. My uncle opened the coin shop in town, and he's doing very well. He's going to retire, and everyone's happy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the outside world of everything that we're talking about just doesn't pierce. I feel like in Massachusetts, people don't realize that life isn't that hard.
Yeah.
Life's hard. It's not this hard.
Generally agree with you. There's a little bit of a distortion, right? Okay, so this is a new record, because I don't think I've ever said the number, the studio call-in line, three times.
Oh, quick look, you say it, steals thunder.
Before the 45-minute mark in particular. But folks, if you're listening and you want to contribute, the call-in line is 855-915-9636. Once again, 855-915-9636. If you're just tuning in, this is Man vs. Mob Radio, and I'm your host, Patrick Clerkin, and my guests in the studio tonight are Chris and Luke. So, okay, the next thing that I was going to bring up is... Oh, and by the way, Luke, you see that binder in front of you?
Yeah.
That is the PSA binder. So once an hour, during, which is basically during every program, we have to read one of those PSAs. So
you can pick one of the you can pick one of those out that you think you like. There's a like 100 PSAs in there.
Oh, I have to read it.
And you can read it if you want, or you could have Chris read it, or I can read it. But I'll read it. But if you're up for it,
I need to talk more.
Cool. It's up to you. But no rush. We just have to read it before the program ends at 8. So, okay, the next thing that I was going to talk about was universal basic income. And I think this is an idea that's growing in popularity. And, you're looking around. Are you looking at people out there? Are you listening to the truck?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I think that album that they have in the window there three times is Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, which is a great band that people should check out. But I've never seen someone have a Herb Albert album, let alone three of the same album.
Well, I'm actually impressed that you recognize that from a distance. So universal basic income, for those of you who don't know, the premise is that particularly now more than ever before, we're going to need some sort of basic income for people, because as technology accelerates in its development, it's going to displace more and more people from jobs. That might sound sort of ridiculous, but if you think about it, I'm referring to, like millennials, Gen Z. So our parents and grandparents, they mostly, I believe, made income with their hands and with their backs, like with labor. And, but a lot of people did. And now it's shifted more towards you make your money with your mind. A lot of careers are more heavily cognitively based. And so it's when people lose a low-skilled job, it's harder to retrain them for the newer jobs of the economy. Like, that's where the meme Learn to Code came from and all the, like, you can't really retrain somebody who was you might with a few people, but you can't really retrain somebody who is, like, say, a coal miner or somebody who's a truck driver to be a coder. So the idea behind the universal basic income is to give people a sense of dignity by giving them a basic income. I've heard a couple different models of it, but essentially the basic one is $1,000 a month, and a lot of people criticize that. So I'm increasingly more in favor of it. But a lot of people say, okay, first of all, $1,000 a month. Nobody's going to live off of $1,000 a month. What are you going to be able to do off of that? And
not,
I think,
this property value.
Exactly. So I think that those people are missing the point in that it's not to live off of, it's to defray some of the cost, some of the pressure, to alleviate some of the pressure. And then another criticism that I've heard is, okay, so let me back up for a second. There are different ways of implementing it, but one of them is, how are you going to pay for it? So I've heard, okay, we could put a tax on automation. I don't know how much that would actually pay for. I've also heard of another interesting theory, which I'll loop back to Charles Murray, who I mentioned before, the guy that wrote The Bell Curve and who wrote Coming Apart, a couple of very interesting books, which I recommend. He's a libertarian, a small L libertarian, meaning he's not affiliated with the Libertarian Party. But basically, he believes in small government. So this is coming from a libertarian. He wrote a book called In Our Hands about universal basic income. And he was basically saying he increasingly sees it as a necessity. And he was saying also that this is the trade-off. If we allow people to spend, if we allow the government to spend a tremendous amount of money on this program, then the trade is that they will allow people to lead lives as they like lead lives of dignity, and the government will stop trying to micromanage people's lives. That's the idea of the trade-off. So Murray's idea is that we would basically take all of the current entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP, all that, welfare, we would take that and push it directly, fold it into a universal basic income. And his version of it has $1,000 a month, and in addition, $3,000 that's withheld for
catastrophic health care. So people can't squander their health care money, basically. And there are some interesting elements of this. One of them is it gets rid of the incentive to have babies to get more benefits, because his version of it would only apply when you're 18. So you only start getting benefits when you're 18. Another incentive that it would eliminate, he has a minor clawback of this this universal basic income. I think if you make like over $30,000, but only a minor. And that's hugely important, because current welfare, if you start making above a certain amount, you lose your benefits. So therefore, it keeps people under the poverty line because they want to maintain their benefits. Mm. So in a universal basic income system like this, it would be more additive. So I like that. And then and this is the last two things, because I realize I'm droning, but it's also I'm really just trying to expose people to the idea here. I've heard criticisms of universal basic income that it's just another system that people are going to exploit, and you know, what's why even bother with that? Any system, people will figure out a way to exploit. I recognize that. But the two main things that are exploitable with the current system, first of all, people getting benefits who shouldn't have benefits, people finding a way to get the benefits, that's not going to be an issue anymore because it's universal. It's applicable to anybody. Everybody, even the wealthiest people, is going to get $1,000 a month. So, you know, there's no getting benefits that you don't deserve because everybody is getting it. And then the other thing is spending the money on things that you're not supposed to. And that's another thing that is inherently built into universal basic income, is it's supposed to give people the dignity of spending the money on whatever they want to spend it on. Right. So there's no, oh, I'm taking the money that I'm supposed to spend on food and buying cigarettes or whatever like that. Sure, people can spend their universal basic income on cigarettes, on drugs, on video games, on whatever.
They have
it,
but right,
that's their right to do. Like, that's the dignity of it. Like, one of the main problems with the current system of welfare is that it gives people no dignity in how they can use the money that they're given. So one of the main ways that people get a sense of dignity is coming up with creative ways to game the system. So I see all kinds of potential to this idea. I don't think it's just something to laugh at anymore. That's why I'm bringing it up. So I don't know if you had any comments on it, but I just think it's intriguing. I think it's very intriguing. And I think you're going to hear about it more and more.
Canada did this in the 70s, didn't they? Do you know anything about that experiment?
Canada, you said?
I believe for a couple of years in the 70s, Canada did universal basic income.
Interesting. I didn't know Canada did it. I think that Finland attempted to do it on a small scale and it failed. And I think that one of the reasons that it failed is because they didn't, they made it so that you lost your benefits if you like used universal basic income or something like that.
You lost your health benefits through work?
Something like that. Like, the benefits weren't additive. You, like, if you used universal basic income, you lost your other benefits or something like that. So there
wouldn't just by nature everyone be using it?
Well, it was in a controlled group of people. Okay. And I think that I don't remember the details off the top of my head, but there was a small study done in Finland, a finite group of people, and it failed. But I think it was because they missed like a key element in sort of the rollout of how it would be done, which is you get rid of the other programs. And and by the way, like, one, like, if this were ever done in this way, of course, like, you would have to basically have a phase out where you can't just say, all right, everybody, we're removing the existing programs. That would cause chaos, right? I mean, like, and we were talking earlier about generations, like, you can't just remove benefits that baby boomers, for example, who are going into retirement are relying on.
But they worked all their life.
And they contributed towards that they like justifiably earned. It would be more like of a phase out after, like, okay, people within the
baby boomer age cohort, they would get their full benefits as is, and then we would phase out into a universal basic income system. That would be sort of the way that I would see it going down. But if you don't have any other comments on universal basic income, the last thing that I was going to talk about was marijuana.
I just like staring at you and watching you flounder for a couple of seconds before topics.
Well, I try to judge basically if you're about to say something, and I said, all right, okay, I don't think he is. So the last thing was marijuana legalization, and I don't know. What are your thoughts on it?
That passed.
Well,
did you not read the paper today?
No, I know.
Federally?
No, not federally.
I know that. And the last, basically federally.
I mean, of course it should be legal. It's ridiculous that it is illegal.
Did you hear what Joe Biden said?
He thinks it's gateway.
It's a gateway. Right? Yeah.
It's a gateway. Yeah.
It. You know what though? I'll say this. It is not in the fire and brimstone way that.
Yeah,
that they, you know, smoke a joint, you'll be shooting smack. But it is people that end up doing acid and tripping and doing other things. They started smoking weed first. It's the most accessible thing. But that, I don't think that makes it the
yes
inevitable.
I'm with you on that. But think about it this way: so it is a gateway. So if you look at the group of people, the cohort of people who are hard drug users, and you said how many of those people started drug use with marijuana, it would be a pretty high percentage.
Right.
I would guess like 70, 80, maybe higher percent.
And if you rounded up a bunch of bankers that tripped acid when they were 19 and asked them how their drug use started, they'd probably have the same story.
Right. So that's looking in one direction. But if you look in the reverse direction and you said, all right, I'm going to take all of the people who use marijuana or have used marijuana, and I want to know what percentage of them go on to hard drug use, I think it would be a very small percentage. It's looking at mm-hmm. it from a different angle. The people who are hard drug users started out using marijuana because it's a softer drug.
It's a gateway drug, right?
But so the people, marijuana, if you use harder drugs, you likely started with marijuana, but marijuana doesn't necessitate you going on to harder drugs. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Right.
And so the point that I was thinking about earlier is it's kind of like saying, well, cars are very dangerous. They're sort of a menace to society because they cause all these accidents and fatalities. And generally, people who drive cars started out riding a bicycle. So why don't we ban bicycles?
I bet most pretty alcoholics good point. Started with soda.
What'd you say?
I bet most alcoholics started with soda.
Exactly.
And Diet Coke.
So, you know, like, just because you ride a bicycle doesn't mean you're going to go on to ride a to drive a car. It doesn't mean you're going to go on to kill people in a car. It doesn't mean any of those things. But, like, basically the point is you take on risk in having these systems that some people are going to mess up. Some people are going to use the thing like they're not supposed to.
I think that's such a relic of an argument, though, the gateway.
People are smarter
about everything now.
Mm. Yeah.
Especially dope. People nerd out about that stuff.
Well, I think that also, though, the pro-marijuana legalization people can be, because I've had conversations with people on both sides, and I think that the pro-legalization people can be a bit arrogant or a bit deceptive in how they hide any potential right. effects. They go, oh, no. Like, they really, really downplay it. And one of the things...
There's no negative effects.
Exactly. Right. One of the things that I'm concerned about is, you know, the effect on developing brains. Teenagers, young people. I think it really does have an effect on how they develop. And I think that's really something that you should be able to talk about and say, hey, we don't know what that's going to do.
But could the same be said for... Suppose somebody has clinical anxiety or clinical depression. Could the same thing be said about antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications prescribed to teenagers with panic attacks or severe depression?
I think probably.
Yeah. So what difference does it make? I mean, one's illegal, the other is marketed by huge pharmaceutical drug corporations.
I think that it's going to get pretty interesting when we try to figure, when we start to figure out sort of where the money is and who's lobbying for what. But so I'm looking at the time right now. Oh, I'm realizing that we have basically 15 seconds left. Oh, well. So look, I just wanted to thank both of you guys for being on tonight. I know that there were a couple segments where I was basically just blabbering for like 5-10 minutes. So thank you for enduring that. I hope.